Welcome to the Negro Leagues, Our Major Leagues podcast, a production of Sports Reference. I'm your host, Curtis Harris, and today we are joined by Todd Peterson. Originally from Minnesota, Peterson now lives in Kansas City and wrote the book Early Black Baseball in Minnesota. Recently, he also edited the fantastic anthology, The Negro Leagues Were Major Leagues, Historians Reappraise Black Baseball. The title of that book may have been a slight inspiration for the title of this podcast. Just maybe. Perhaps. Probably. But Todd's work has also been published in Baseball Research Journal, as well as Blackball. And today on the podcast, we discuss the on-field play between black and white players during the era of segregation, and how that helped prove that the black leagues were indeed major league quality. And also just discuss in general the operations of Negro League baseball during that era, as well as why he wrote or helped write and edit The Negro Leagues Were Major Leagues. So without further ado, here's Todd Peterson. All right, so welcome to the Negro Leagues, Our Major Leagues podcast. And today we're joined by Todd Peterson. And Todd, I'd like for you to just introduce yourself. I always think that's worthwhile to have the guests kind of tell people who they are in their own words and also what you do.
Todd Peterson, I'm a teacher and a historian and artist, originally from Minneapolis, and I now live in the Kansas City area for the past 16 years or so. And I've been doing Negro League research for about almost 25 years.
All right. And what got you interested in baseball history and also, you know, Negro League baseball history in particular?
Well, I was thinking about that. When I was a kid, I don't know if it's Sports Illustrated or somebody had a book series, a book club. And so my parents, for a birthday, enrolled me in that, which was great. So they had a lot of great books came through. I was able to read. So that got me going. I always loved baseball, and I also loved box scores. They had a thing called newspapers back then, so we could read newspapers and read the box scores. And so that just got me going. So all those things. And the Negro Leagues, I think a lot of this is a common answer, but a book by a man named Robert Peterson called Only the Ball Was White. I came across that in the library, I think downtown Minneapolis library one day, and that was kind of a genesis for that. You know, I noticed in there he had a great roster of player roster he put together. And I noticed they had St. Paul Gophers, and so of all things Minnesota, and it got me intrigued about that. So that it stewed for a while, and then a few years ago I got back into it. I started going over to the Historical Center in Minneapolis and in St. Paul, actually, and started digging into it, and that just got me going, sort of a passion.
All right, yeah, and you about your first book was about black baseball in Minnesota. And then you put together this anthology of, I forget the number of writers, but it's quite a few writers the book, The Negro Leagues Were Major Leagues. So what, I guess, inspired you to first get into that first book you wrote about Minnesota baseball in particular, and then to go on and help edit this anthology on Negro League baseball?
Well, yeah, Minnesota, just the local tie. And then just the Gophers are somebody's very, very fascinating story. About these guys in Minnesota at the turn of the 20th century. And they had a lot of great local black players, and they brought in a lot of guys from elsewhere, and it sort of blew up into sort of a scene. And they had many teams before and the teams after. And they had two, you know, it's Minneapolis and St. Paul, so there's always two teams. So St. Paul had a team, and Minneapolis, of course, had to go have a team. So the two teams were very interesting. The Keystones and the Gophers were very interesting clubs. The Gophers are very good. Were a great club in 1909. The Keystones were pretty good too, and they had many interesting players. Many fascinating things happened to them and they played all over. They played in Minnesota and all over the Midwest and the Dakotas and Wisconsin and Iowa, kind of their stomping grounds. And they sort of laid the groundwork for other black teams that followed those guys. You know, it's in the DNA of, you know, Minnesota sports fans are still there 100 years later. The Gophers are still there. Keystones are still there. Because they were a big deal. When they came to town on a Sunday, the whole town was there to watch them play. So that got me going on that. I found it very fascinating. And that got me involved in things like Sabre. I joined, and Sabre's got a great thing called the Molloy Conference, a Negro Leagues conference, headed up by Larry Lester, who's a great historian, and Leslie Heafy. They put this together every year. And 1 year was held in Pittsburgh, I think it was 2014 or so, 13 or so. And we noticed that this is the second conference there. And the first conference there, they had, we went to a PNC Park, and they had statues of Negro League greats in the concourse all around the area. So you could see a statue of Josh Gibson, and all the Satchel Paige, all these great players who played for the Grays or the Crawfords. But then we came back, and the statues were gone. And it turned out that the Pirates had just decided they didn't belong there anymore, so they just got rid of them and sold them off. And the controversy, they sort of lied about what they did with the statues. And that just got us thinking. And I've always had that feeling, that the Negro Leagues were major leagues. And there's always been kind of an undercurrent about that. So we decided at that point, that was sort of we got to talking, and one thing led to another. And they just thought, well, let's find out. Let's just find some numbers and prove what we already know. And so I got about 13 writers together. Asked a lot of people, and the 13 guys finally agreed to do it. And that's the start of that. And then a few years later, we published it. And then a year later after that, MLB made the move to recognize Negro League. So it was a few books. I think they have you list in your preface what you want the book to do, and that was our goal. Mm-hmm. And it happened, so that was great.
Yeah, and then the portion, or I actually go here, the title of it, again, to remind the listener, is The Negro Leagues Were Major Leagues. Obviously, there's many titles you could have taken, writing an anthology about Negro League baseball, but you all had a point that you wanted to make. I mean, the title, I think, insists upon that point. So in your opinion, and also, just with your research as well, why were the Negro Leagues major league quality? Obviously, you wrote about it, but, explain why. And why is it important to make that recognition?
Well, one side note, my title was Negro Leagues equals Major Leagues. So The good people at McFarland who published it, they came up with a much better title. So
they did. So. Well, that's what editors and publishers are for.
That's what they're for, because, my title was not as good as theirs. So they came up with a great title. And so I wrote a piece and did a lot of the research and a lot of the charts and things. And I came up with these points that went through in my article. And then covered it, various points of this throughout the book as well. And one of them was, we went to look at head-to-head competition between Negro League teams and Major League teams. And it turned out that Negro League teams had a winning record. And they've been playing, even though there was segregation, people wanted to see Black players play all over the country. And so they it's sort of a secret, but it's not really a secret, but they've been playing for, since the 1860s, Black teams against white teams. And it was a big draw, and Major Leaguers would do it because it was a big draw for them as a way to line their pockets in the fall. We found out through some research that Black teams had a winning record, and they also performed very well in those games. And then we looked and found out that we looked at the leagues themselves, and we used kind of some pitching metrics or hitting metrics, and under the theory that, a league that has stronger pitching is, a strong league. And so we compared the leagues, the stats we had with MLB and also AAA teams. So we found out they performed, better than, they had lower averages in many categories, and also higher strikeout rates and lower whip, to get technical about it, than AAA and MLB. And so we laid that out. So that was another thing. And then we looked at how did they perform when they finally got to the majors, how did they perform? And also AAA, when they were allowed in AAA, Black players. And they performed well above league level in AAA and also MLB. And then we sort of looked, how did they perform, when the second generation of Black players came in, or the first generation of Black players that didn't play in the Negro Leagues, how did they perform? And so we looked at the next, 30 years after integration. And off the charts, they're winning, Black players are winning the majority of awards, MVPs. They're just dominating. And then We looked at, went and looked at population. What is the, you know, what's current population of Black players, you know, including, you know, there's a lot said about, you know, the decline of American Black players playing African-American, but the Black Latin American player has really blown up. And I think that's a direct correlation to the Negro Leagues, because they played everywhere and they sort of started, they lead the genesis of that. So that's, I think that's an indirect result of their play. And again, it's the percentage is very high, and there are now, you know, there are now more Black players in MLB than there ever were in the Negro Leagues. So that's another thing we discovered. So those are some of the things we looked at. And also kind of a more subtle thing is just the kind of how MLB sort of appropriated MLB culture. And they started wearing the uniforms about 30 years ago, 25 years ago. And they did it almost 100 times. So I thought that very interesting that you would, you know, you didn't really recognize this. This is a league you sort of made happen because you wouldn't let them play in your league. But then you go and you're wearing their uniforms with an MLB patch on your shoulder almost 100 times. So all these different things we looked at, and what my article was about, and then the other authors were gracious enough to put up with me and write along those lines as well.
Yeah, the point about, I guess the, it seems almost like appropriation of the Negro Leagues, where, as you mentioned, you know, the Negro Leagues only existed because, you know, what becomes white Major League Baseball wouldn't let them play, at least, you know, not play together. And then, of course, when integration happens, Black owners and Black teams aren't allowed into the AL and NL, only the Black players are taken in. And yet, decades later, you'll wear the Grays and the Monarchs and all the other teams' jerseys and try to make money off what you created in a really bad way.
Very bad way. But that's MLB for you. They eventually do the right thing, but rarely for the right reasons. So,
yeah, that's, well, that happens often in history. People.
that is true. So
it seems to be a human problem, a human issue. Yep. But I don't want you to get too deep into the numbers, because, you know, this is an audio format. So I know we can't have, like, you know, just numbers floating around. But you mentioned a lot about, you know, the wins and the pitching statistics. Was there anything in particular, you know, maybe one, two or three things that really stood out to you? That signified that the Negro Leagues were operating, the players in the Negro Leagues were just as capable, if not better than the white players in those leagues?
Well, I think a lot of it was the statistics when they played head to head. They were very, you know, the ML and, you know, Negro Leaguers were doing very well, almost every category they lead in. Now, MLB was aware of this. So in the early 20s, Judge Landis said, no more, you can't. Previous to that, 1922 or so, they could wear their uniforms. And so the Cardinals could play the St. Louis Giants, or the Lincoln Giants could play the Phillies, and it would be uniform against uniform. And but once 1920 hit and the Negro League started, things really started, the play really started to improve, because they were, you know, playing more games against each other, just, I think, a natural result of that. And it became even more apparent that these guys are good, and this is hurting the brand of MLB. So Landis said, you know, enough of this. If you want to keep playing, you can only have three guys from any one team play, and you can't wear your uniforms anymore. So you got to call yourself all-star teams. Mm-hmm. And so that became an all-star period. Prior, it was sort of head-to-head, but now it's mostly all-stars. But it was still the same. I mean, it was still, you know, a lot of nine major leaguers playing. You could tell by the stats that, you know, it would go up and down, but the Negro Leaguers dominated almost every category. And things like fielding, which, you know, they're often derided for, their fielding average over about, I think it was like almost 477 games, is identical. So that struck me. There are more, the Negro Leaguers turn more double plays, but the fielding average is the same. And I thought that was very interesting. So that's just a head-to-head stat. And I think just the across the board on batting average and on base and slugging and OPS, I cannot get too technical, in their own leagues, the Negro Leaguers' averages were lower across the board against both MLB compared to MLB and compared to AAA. So those are numbers that got to me. I said, well, that something's going on here. And they consistently did that. I looked, you know, year by year by year, and it was just every year they were outperforming. So those things I saw were very interesting. That sort of said, aha, this is, you know, we can, this is a good way to prove it, other than just common sense. Because I would tell a lot of people I'm working on this project, and they would just say, yeah, oh, really? Yeah, of course. Yeah, so, you know, most people sort of just got it. Other people you had to sort of, they're still not, probably not going to believe it for a long time, if ever. So,
well, yeah, I like that point. Yeah, the common sense is just like, yeah, it makes sense that, you know, black players would be just as good as white players. Like, why not? Yeah, so as you said, some people need various forms of convincing. I got the book here with me. Again, don't want to throw out too many, you know, stats and figures, and also encourage people, you know, to, you know, you should purchase the book. But the head-to-head that Todd was able to compile of Negro League versus MLB competition from 1900 to 1924. Let's see, the wins, yeah, pretty comparable. You know, Negro Leagues won 47 games, Major Leagues won 59. So,
yeah.
And that's in the early 1900s.
And I'll put an asterisk on that, too, mm-hmm. is that a lot of games weren't reported.
So, yeah, yes, very important, yeah.
So that's kind of important. So, you know, it's not an excuse. It's just the way it is. So oftentimes, we know the Giants, Lincoln Giants played the Yankees or New York Giants, but there's, I think they played them up east somewhere, but the games, there's reports of them winning, you know, many, many games that weren't reported. And there's an example in the Chicago Press, the American Giants beat a military team made of major leaguers. And it wasn't reported. The buildup was reported in the Chicago Tribune and all those papers, but the result was not printed because the, you know, American Giants won. And so we're not going to print the box score. We're not going to tell you about it. We're just going to bury it. And that happened a lot. So, you know, and there's new space, and it might be November, October. So sometimes, you know, it's just the way it goes. It didn't get reported, but sometimes it's like, or, you know, you beat our major leaguers. We're not going to talk about it. So we're going to bury the story. And that happened a lot.
Yeah. Similar situation. I'm by trade a basketball historian in that same era. You know, it gets very hard to find a lot of box scores for particularly barnstorming games, which essentially, you know, the white versus black games, those are basically exhibitions. So those are very difficult to track. And yeah, basketball, similar story. It's very hard to find specific statistics.
Well, yeah.
What player got what stat? So yeah, I perfectly understand how the issue in baseball, similar situation.
Yeah, like if the Rens are beating someone, they're not going to talk about it a lot. So
yeah, they're going to. Or to say the Rens won. Like the Rens have won, like, you know, 50 out of 60 games, but then I actually tell you, okay, what are the actual specific 50 games they won? Yeah. It's very, very hard to get that info.
Yeah, they're going to.
Yeah, and the Rens, by the way, for those of you who aren't into basketball, the New York Renaissance, excellent all-black basketball team from the 1920s, 30s, and 40s.
Think best team in the country.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. The white players, even back then, what's his name? Joe Lapchick, who played for the barnstorming Celtics, the Boston Celtics, but this was a barnstorming one. Yeah. He said the New York Rens, best basketball team in the country back in that era. He didn't hesitate for a moment.
No. And yeah, they were. So,
yeah,
I think they made, I think they finally made the Hall of Fame though. So,
yeah. Yes, they did. But what you're researching in baseball was prevalent in many forms in American society. So as we just talked about here with basketball, but it would exude itself in other other parts of America. I mean, segregation and Jim Crow was, you know, clearly pervasive. It wasn't relegated to one part of the country. So which actually brings me to what I think is the most important question for every podcast I host. Why do you think it is important for people to know about the history of Negro League baseball, and not simply, you know, a specific team, a specific player, a specific stat, but like, why is it important just to be aware of what happened with the Negro Leagues?
Big, great question. And many answers. I think one of them, it's often mistaken, but it's like half of baseball history. So it's, people have to know it. If you love baseball, it's half the story. I mean, John Holloway said that famous, great, researcher and historian, it's at least half of baseball history. And so, and you can't tell the whole story without it, because they were playing each other. Everybody knew they were playing each other. They're able to bury it for a long time, many years till after they stopped playing. You couldn't find the stats, or they didn't talk about it, but it's kind of sad. You can't bury a great story. It's going to get out. And that's important for the country too. I mean, you can still see the issues that we're having, and it's important to know just their achievements and accomplishments, these great players and all they did. And they had to, it was harder. It was just more difficult. Their leagues were, it was just, beyond the stats they did, it was tough to play. They didn't have their own ballparks for the most part. So they had to be great at organizing things. And that got criticized. People said, well, it was just a haphazard league. It was, and that's ridiculous. It was a different kind of league. And so I think that has to be understood as well. It was just more of a fluid operation. They had to, figure out schedules using many different parks. Resources weren't always there. They had to, kind of operate more on the fly. And they did a tremendous job. It's often derided, and, Branch Rickey called it a racket, but he was, rating, paying, not paying fair value for players. And so it's the major leagues, it's, you talk about a racket. It's at least half of the story of baseball. So it's important to know. You can't know the whole story. And I think it's great the Baseball Reference is incorporating it, doing all these fantastic things. And so now you can see leaderboards with all the players, and that's tremendous. And so in 30 years, hopefully kids won't care. They're not, maybe they'll forget that story, or they won't know. They'll just see, they'll look at the leaderboard and Baseball Reference or wherever it winds up, and they're going to see all those players and see Ty Cobb number one, they'll see Oscar Charleston number two, and that's the way it ought to be.
Yeah. And your point about the derision that was given towards the Negro League operations, and as you said, might be called haphazard and all that kind of stuff, but you got to realize, why was it haphazard? Why was it haphazard in the first place? Because you weren't allowing them to actually access, I guess, the easier way of doing things. So you kind of forced them to have to take the hard road, and they did it quite well, despite the hardships.
Yeah, they did an incredible job. They rarely did a league fold, and it was maybe during the Depression. So the leagues would, we find out now that they finish their seasons, they play a full slate. Things happen. There's not always strong central leadership. So the owners, any league with owners have a lot of power. Things mm-hmm. happen. So that would occur. So sometimes playoffs don't always happen. Things go a little haywire there, but they these are professional teams, and they're playing a lot more. They're not just playing each other. They're playing, playing semi-pro teams, or playing minor league teams, and they're filling up their schedules, paying their players for the most part on time and getting through seasons. So it's not a racket. It wasn't haphazard. It was just different.
Well, thank you, Todd, for enlightening us on just some of the reasons why the Negro Leagues were major league and should be considered major league when we look back at the history of baseball. And as you put it, I think quite well, it's at least half the story of baseball is, what occurred with black players, and not just the black players, but just, how the Negro Leagues operated, why they had to exist, why they were forced to exist. And it's you don't get the full story of baseball without the story of the Negro Leagues. So thank you for sharing your stories and your research and just your thoughts about this with us.
Thank you so much, Chris.
So I'd like again to express my appreciation for Todd Peterson for joining us today on the Negro Leagues Are Major Leagues podcast. And I hope what y'all gained from listening to the show today was just a better grasp and a better thought process on how to consider the black and white players and black and white leagues from that era of segregation, and just ultimately how the history of baseball is incomplete without including those black players and the Negro Leagues. So with that said, I'll see y'all back again here on the Negro Leagues Are Major Leagues podcast.